My name is Chris Kimball. I'm president here at CLU, and it's my pleasure to welcome all of you, particularly those of you that have not been to campus before. A very special welcome. It's also my responsibility to interrupt your lively conversations and move us on to the agenda for today. This is the third in our series of Corporate Leaders Breakfast for this year, 2008-2009, today featuring Michael Tobes, and he will surely continue what has been an outstanding series. I wanted to take note of some important individuals and groups this morning. First of all, the sponsors of this series are essential in making it possible. I wanted to not only read their names to you, but ask that any representatives from those firms that are here please stand, and then we could recognize them collectively. They are Merrill Lynch, Rabobank, Pacific Coast Business Times, Pierce Brothers Valley Oaks, Griffin Memorial Park, Santa Barbara Bank and Trust, Sodexo, Nordman Cormany Hare and Compton, and the Ventura County Star. Let's thank all of them for their sponsorship. This university is dedicated to offering a top-quality, rigorous education in the arts and sciences and the professions. That's our core mission, but that's something that one doesn't do in isolation, and so it's very important for us to have this opportunity to bring people together, to hear speakers with important messages about the world in which we live. It's also an opportunity for those of us on the campus to connect with people off campus. And I think this event has become an opportunity for many people to network with old friends and to meet new acquaintances, and particularly people with whom one might be able to work together in the future. Today we have, again, a number of people who are first-time visitors, and I hope that you capture some of that spirit that I think this event has done a fine job of promoting. Because we're a university, I think it's important to recognize that we rely on a top-quality faculty and staff to work with our students. And while Sharon Nelson in the back is probably the person most responsible for this event this morning, there are a lot of other people who have done extraordinary work. And I would ask that the faculty, staff, administration, and students from Cal Lutheran just stand and be recognized. We also have several members from our Board of Regents here, as well as some past members of our board, and several past presidents of the university, though the standing joke around here is we have a lot more past presidents than we used to have. I would ask that board members and presidents, past and present, stand up and let us recognize you as well. As I said, we take pride in this series, and one of the things that has made it better over time is the suggestions and comments that we get from you, the people that attend. So it is my duty and pleasure also to remind you now, and I'll do it again at the end, to take the evaluation cards that are on your table. Please fill them out and leave them in the back at the end of this morning and give us feedback so that we can make this event ever more useful to you. Well, it's now my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Michael Tobes. He is chairman and owner of the Tobes Group, a construction development and asset management company based in Santa Barbara. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering from Princeton and did graduate work at MIT. The Tobes Group manages more than 1.6 million square feet of commercial space and nearly 2,000 apartment units. He's built thousands of housing units, a mobile home park, shopping centers, office buildings, and business parks throughout the Tri-County area. He's been general contractor for several low-income housing projects and is senior life director of the National Association of Home Builders and has chaired its Commercial Industrial Council. Mr. Tobes is also chairman and owner of Montecito Bank and Trust, a Santa Barbara-based bank with assets of over $700 million and 7 branches in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. He was one of the founders of the bank, which opened in 1975. A resident of Santa Barbara for more than 48 years and a community leader, he has served and chaired many, many local nonprofit boards, for example, serving on the board of Cottage Hospital for 25 years, including 5 years as its chair. He is one of Santa Barbara's leading philanthropists and has given generously to create the Granada Performing Arts Center in Santa Barbara and to assure the continued presence of Santa Barbara's classical music station, KDB. And I'm also glad to say that he is a friend and supporter of KCLU here as well. Michael Tobes has been honored as Santa Barbara Man of the Year and was a recipient of the Santa Barbara News Press Lifetime Achievement Award and the UCSB Chancellor's Medal. He's been chosen both as Santa Barbara Philanthropist of the Year and Santa Barbara Volunteer of the Year by the National Society of Fundraising Executives. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest and speaker, Michael Tobes.
Chris, thank you for that very nice introduction. It doesn't leave much for me to say. It's a pleasure being here. I can't say that I have been to this campus very often, but it is a beautiful place, and you should be proud of what you have here. It's a great campus, and I'm very happy to be here today. Let me start out by cheering you up a little bit. We all need a little of that. The National Bureau of Economic Research, whatever they are, just announced that the recession started in the fourth quarter of 2007. Now, recessions normally last a year to 18 months, so we're halfway through this recession. Also, remember that every day that goes by is one day closer to the next boom. While I am certainly involved with Montecito Bank and Trust, I consider myself to be a developer and not a banker. I'm not a lender, but I'm a very experienced borrower. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and went to college in the East. I had never been west of Detroit until I joined the Navy, the Civil Engineer Corps, in 1952, and they sent me to this place with a strange name, Point Magoo. And I remember Mr. Magoo and thinking, was it anything like Mr. Magoo? But I spent 18 months living in the bachelor officer's quarters at Point Magoo, right on the shores of the Pacific Ocean, and said, hey, this is pretty nice territory. So when I got out of the service, I was married by that time, I decided to come back to California and settled in Los Angeles. And about a year after working for a general contractor, I formed a partnership with a family friend from Washington, Eli Luria. We started building on a very small scale in Santa Barbara, in Los Angeles. And then we heard that there was going to be a big boom at Vandenberg Air Force Base in Santa Barbara County because it had just been reactivated as a missile center after it had been in mothballs for many years as the old Camp Cook. So Eli and I came to Santa Barbara. We looked around and decided there were opportunities in that area, and there really was a tremendous housing boom. In 1959, there were 9,000 housing units built in Santa Barbara County. Now we build about 700 or 800 a year. So you can imagine for a county, it was less than half the size it is today. 9,000 housing units was a lot of housing. Anyway, after getting involved in this area, Eli moved to Santa Barbara to keep an eye on what we were doing there. I moved to Santa Maria, and I lived there for 18 months. In 1960, moved to Santa Barbara, and I've lived in Santa Barbara since that time. I've been in the development business now for about 52 and a half years. And during that time, I've never had a foreclosure or given a property back to a lender. I can say that as of today. We'll see about the future. But I doubt that many builders have been in business that long, and certainly not very many can say that they have that kind of a record. My approach to development has really been threefold, and I think I was fortunate that I sort of had a game plan early in my career and pretty much stuck to it. The first part of the game plan was diversity. Many builders build houses, or they build shopping centers, or they build apartments, and that's what they do. I decided that diversity really was important over the long haul. So we do everything from houses to condominiums to shopping centers, apartments, office buildings, industrial parks, even a few mobile home parks along the way. And the thing that I think has been so good about that is there's almost never a time when all of these are out of favor. So we have managed to stay busy over the years, even though one market or another hasn't done very well. The second part of my goal was geography. And maybe it's just sheer laziness, but my goal was not to build anything that I couldn't drive to in an hour. And so just about everything that I've developed is right along the 101 corridor from Westlake to San Luis Obispo counties. And one of the benefits of that, I think, as it turned out to be, is that in many of these areas, the barriers to entry are very high. And what that really means is when there is a slowdown, it's not like it is in places like Las Vegas or Phoenix or places where not only does the market slow down, but there's a tremendous supply of housing. So I think that's stood me in very good stead over the years. And I must admit that it is very frustrating at times to be dealing with that. We just started an apartment building in Goleta that we've been working on for 8 years. But my record is 19 years from the time I started the first phase of a project and then had to deal with a water moratorium that lasted for about 15 years and finally got to build the second phase of a project. Now, the good news, that was the first phase we sold these condos for about $25,000. The second phase we sold for about $250,000. So there were some benefits in waiting. We currently own and manage properties from Westlake to the north end of Santa Maria, though I have done some development in San Luis Obispo County, including the Pismo Beach Factory Outlet Center. The other part of the game plan, if you call it that, is building projects for investment and for property management. And we have a good-sized property management department. My idea was to build for sale projects for cash flow and build investment properties to hold for long-term investments. And when I say long-term, I mean long-term. I think the longest property I've owned goes back to 1965. So that's 43 years. And it's still doing well. And as long as we maintain them, and I've found over the years that it's been more profitable to build and hold investment properties, especially in the Tri-Counties, than to build and sell and build and sell. Property management is very important to our company. It's a steadying influence that produces cash flow and keeps a large part of my staff busy in the construction company. And actually, most of the people who work in the TOES group are involved in property management in one way or another. Not everything that we have managed over the years are properties we've developed, but about 80 to 90% are, and we've also acquired a few properties over the years. We're currently building a 200-unit apartment project in Goleta. We're about half finished, and we just finished a 75,000-square-foot office building near the airport in Santa Barbara. And we also have about 10 houses we're really trying very hard to sell in Santa Maria. So there's a little bit of everything. But in the pipeline, we have a lot of projects. And fortunately, we can just wait until the market is right. But they are everything from single-family homes to more apartments to office buildings. So what I've learned is that the approval process is so long in the areas that I build in that we have to have lots of things in the pipeline. So when people come to my office and look at our conference room wall and they see all these projects on the wall, right now most of those are just pieces of paper that we hope to do at some point or another. But every once in a while one pops out and we actually get to build it. We recently started a group called Tobes Capital Partners with several of my associates in the company, and we have a different program. We've been buying net leased office buildings around the country with investors, people we know and people who've asked about the possibility of investing with the Tobes Group. And right now we have six properties in four states, from Florida to California. Now, how did I end up owning a bank? Well, in the first few years after I moved to Santa Barbara, I was approached by a group that wanted to start a savings and loan. And I, along with about a half a dozen other people, each chipped in a few thousand dollars and tried to see if we could get a charter for a savings and loan. And in those days, it was very competitive. There wasn't just an open door to opening a financial institution. So we competed with another group, which also wanted to open a savings and loan. The savings and loan commissioner was only going to charter one savings and loan, and they were in a position to capitalize at a greater amount than we were, so they got the charter. But I learned a lot about the savings and loan business, and it really was helpful to me in dealing with people in the savings and loan from whom I was borrowing money. In 1973, I was approached by a group that said they were interested in starting a bank. So I said, well, I know a lot about savings and loans. I'll learn about banks. But lo and behold, we got approval to open a bank. And so the question was, well, gosh, what do we do now? About 1974, we were out trying to raise money. And there was a terrible time in the economy in 74, and the stock market was in the tank. We had a very hard time raising the capital we needed. It would probably seem laughable today, but we were originally approved to open with $1,750,000 in capital. And we went back to the FDIC and we said, we can't raise that much. Can we lower it? And they agreed to lower it to $1,250,000. And we finally opened the doors on St. Patrick's Day of 1975. Another part of the game plan was that no one would own more than 5% of the stock of the bank. But the gentleman with the original idea for the bank, John O'Keefe, and I found when we got close to opening and we hadn't raised that, we had to put in more money to open the doors. So we ended up between us with about 25% of the stock. And then because we had twisted the arms of all of our friends to buy the stock that they had bought, we made the market for the stock. And by about 1980, we owned more than half of the stock. And at that point, we did a tender offer for the rest of the stock and eventually acquired 100% of the stock. John and I were partners for several years. He was about as different from me as any two people could be. They used to say, Mike earned the money and John spent it. We were both in the development business. We had a buy-sell agreement between us. And when the prime rate went up to close to 20% in the early 80s, John got into financial difficulties, had to sell his interest in the bank, and I became the sole shareholder in 1983. People say to me, it must be great to own a bank, and I say, yes, it is if you're successful doing something else, because I don't get a salary at the bank, and all the earnings go to increase the capital of the bank as the bank has grown over the years. We opened a trust department in 1998, about 10 years ago. We were originally Montecito, the Bank of Montecito. We changed our name to Montecito Bank and Trust in 1998. About 6 years ago, because I was a sole shareholder, we converted to a sub-S corporation. And about that time, we started a program called our Community Dividends Program, where every year, the week before Thanksgiving, we invite this year, 140 nonprofits, and we distribute $1 million in donations to those nonprofits. And we've been doing that for 6 years now, so we've given away $6 million through this program. The first year, it was 100 nonprofits, but over the 6 years, the bank's territory has expanded, and now we have offices from Solvang to Westlake Village, including one in Ventura that we've just recently opened. So we've had more nonprofits ask for money, and our geography has spread. So this year it was 140 nonprofits that share in that $1 million. And we try to encourage others to do more in the way of philanthropy, because we think it's very important for a community bank to give back to the community. And if anything, the need of nonprofits these days is probably greater than it's ever been in the past. So it's really not a good time to cut back on supporting the nonprofits in the various communities in which we operate. We are now about $800 million in size. We have a loan-to-deposit ratio of a little under 80%. A lot of our competitors have a loan-to-deposit ratio of over 100%. So we're still in a position of making loans, and we're still looking for good loans. And in fact, our bank is well represented here today. Our president, Janet Garufas, our chief operating officer, Rob Skinner, are here, and several of our officers are also here. So maybe you stand up if people want to talk to you afterwards. And, you know, I get in a little plug for the bank. Now a few words about the economy. I have to spoil all this good stuff. We are certainly in a recession now. There's a chart which shows where we are in terms of growth for California. And you can see that the trend is certainly down. We're losing jobs. And I like charts because they don't just give you a picture in time. They really show you the trends. You can see there are more job losses predicted, and this is from the UCSB economic forecast, and they're predicting more job losses into 2009, even into 2010. And the unemployment rate, which is around 7.5%, they anticipate going up as high as 10%. In terms of real estate business, certainly the housing market is in the tank, and I think that as long as there are a lot of foreclosed properties on the market, that will continue, because that really has driven prices down to levels that are unsustainable for new projects to match. And it also psychologically has the impact on people that they think if they wait another month or another 2 months, prices will be even lower. And when potential buyers think there's a benefit to waiting, they tend to do exactly that, and they just wait for prices to continue to come down. This shows what's happening as far as people actually living and moving out of California. Interesting thing is that foreign immigration is staying pretty level, and that is supporting the apartment market, because most people who are coming here from overseas can't afford a home to start with, but I think it has been helping the rental market. This shows the notices of default filed in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, and you see the way the numbers are have been going up very, very dramatically this year. Interestingly enough, the actual number of deeds recorded is starting down, and notices of default have been going on for some time, and I think that wave of defaults is going to be dropping a bit until there's a next wave of repricing of mortgages, and then it may go up again. Obviously, housing prices are dropping. I think this is an interesting chart. There's a considerable difference between vacancy rates in Ventura County and Santa Barbara County, and among our apartments, we've seen the same thing. The vacancy rate in Santa Barbara County is considerably lower than it is in Ventura County, and maybe one of the reasons is the difficulty in building new projects in Santa Barbara County. There's a statistics put out monthly by the National Association of Home Builders on builder confidence, with 100 being the best, 50 being average. The most recent figure was 5. So there's not a lot of optimism in the building community right now. In terms of banking, there are the number of problem institutions that have been identified by the FDIC, and you can see they've gone up considerably. And that chart tells the story in terms of real estate construction and development loans. That line is continuing to pretty much go straight up. This is an interesting chart because the green line is non-current loans, and you see how rapidly that's going up. Loan loss reserves have been going up, but not as rapidly as non-current loans, and therefore the coverage ratio has been going down, and that's one of the things the regulators have been very concerned about. And it used to be that the measure of a bank's performance was about a 1% return on assets, and you can see that's fallen off the chart. I don't know what happened in the second quarter of 2008, but I think it was a blip, and the banks are going to be sort of bumping along. If they are making a little bit of money, I think they're going to be, in general, they're going to be pretty happy about that. As you know, the government has announced a program called TARP, which is a way of injecting capital into banks. A lot of banks have had a sort of a dilemma. They will only put that money into banks that have CAMEL ratings of 1 or 2, and possibly some banks that are rated 3, which is a system the government has of measuring the quality of banks. So if you decide you really don't need those funds or don't want to deal with the onerous terms, you think, well, we should turn down TARP. And then you have to say, well, what are our customers and our competitors going to say? Gee, Bank X didn't get any TARP money. They must not be a very good bank. So there's sort of a dilemma there as to whether banks should take that money or not. For us, we're a subchapter S bank. There are about 2,500 subchapter S banks in the country, and the government still hasn't decided what the rules are going to be. So we don't know whether we're going to take TARP money because we don't even know whether they're going to offer it to sub-S banks. The problem is that in the banks they have offered the money to, they've been taking preferred shares, and sub-S banks don't have two classes of shares, so they still have to figure out what they're going to do, if they're going to do anything for the sub-S banks. The FDIC is also guaranteeing bonds for banks, and there's been a considerable amount of bonds sold recently by the major banks. Well, why aren't banks making loans? Well, one of the reasons is that they are being beaten over the head and shoulders by the regulators about the quality of their loans, and they're also subject to mark-to-market rules, which have meant that even when they make loans, they may be subject to immediate downgrading on those loans. Just an example of where the credit markets are now. I mentioned we're building 200 units in Goleta right now. We decided this week, gee, the 10-year Treasury is down 2.7%. It's never been that low, and apartment loans are typically priced off of that benchmark. So we talked to the company that we usually do business with, and we've been used to spreads of a year or two ago it was maybe 150 over 10-year Treasuries. Then it went up to about 220 or 230. They quoted 7.75 to 8%. That's more than 500 points over the 10-year Treasury. So that's one reason why loans aren't being made. I think lenders are just being very, very conservative these days. Well, what's going to happen after the housing market? What will be next? I think retail is in serious trouble in lots of places. And I know for my wife and I, we go out to restaurants and we see just lots and lots of empty tables, and that's certainly a sign that that business is really suffering, and most restaurants are sort of hand-to-mouth. I think that our office projects and our industrial projects have held up pretty well through all this, but I think it's still too early in the game to see what's going to happen in the long term. Are things going to get better? Well, I think Obama has made some good choices. I think he's chosen some people who are pragmatic and not dogmatic and are going to be trying to do the things that are right. Bernanke was a student of the Great Depression, and I think we are doing things a lot better than we did then. But we're still in a very serious recession, and it's going to take a lot more time to see all of this worked out. There are a couple of key issues before Congress that should watch carefully. It'll be interesting to see what they do. One is the union checkoff issue, where unions would like to see secret ballots no longer required for to determine union membership. Davis-Bacon, which is a law that requires generally higher wages than are typically paid in an area to be used. And if there's going to be a major public works programs going forward, I think there's a question as whether Davis-Bacon will really work. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the motor companies. I think a decision is coming down on that pretty soon, and it's hard to tell at this point what Congress is going to do about it once they get over their concern about the private airplanes that the CEOs are flying in. As far as predictions, I'll just end by saying I don't make predictions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Now we're going to move to the Q&A portion of the program, and we're very grateful that Henry Dubroff of the Pacific Coast Business Times has offered to facilitate that. So Henry and Michael get to come up to the table here at the front.
We're on now.
Well, I'll take the moderator's prerogative here and ask a quick question. And, you know, you make it hard because you won't predict, Mike. But, you know, you alluded to shortly after you started in business, the tough decade of the 70s hit. And we really didn't come out of that, as I recall, until 1982, 83, when the stock market started to go up and interest rates started to come down. If you will, compare and contrast a little bit what you see now to that time.
Well, one thing that I remember very clearly was that the stock market was just absolutely flat for a period of years in those days, and we didn't have the kind of volatility that we have now. I think one thing that really shakes investors is movements of 500 and 600 points a day in the Dow Jones average. I mean, that's enough, I think, to scare anyone. So I think that's certainly a major change. I think that the government officials, the people at the Fed, are more sophisticated and have learned from some of these past periods of time. And, you know, they are pumping a tremendous amount of money into the economy right now. And it wasn't too long ago when the major fear of the Fed was inflation. In fact, it was probably less than a year ago. They said, gee, inflation. We need to be careful that we don't have inflation. That isn't a problem today. In fact, I think oil is now under $50 a barrel. So, you know, that's a drop from $140-some a barrel in just a few months. So hopefully we have learned a few things from the 70s and some of the other recessions. But I think because we've had such a bubble in the economy, it's going to take a while for this to all unwind.
Thanks. Another question. You alluded to some houses for sale up in Santa Maria area. We feel your pain. Is there a rate, a mortgage rate, today at which you might feel comfortable moving those houses? And do you think the Fed might try to or have a goal of driving the 30-year fixed rate mortgage closer to 4 than to 6?
Well, lowering interest rates would certainly help. But I must say the biggest problem now is from lenders who are making these loans in terms of qualifying buyers. Lenders are just operating in an atmosphere of fear now because of the regulators. And so on the one hand, you have the government saying, we're going to give you all this TARP money, and we want you to go out and make loans. And then when the banks make loans, they're subject to criticism or they're forced to mark the loans to market. So I think they're being very, very conservative. And I think that, wearing my banker's hat, I think that everyone needs to get on the same page. And so far, I don't think that's happened.
So ways to go before the housing market can clear. Well, we want this to be your turn. Mike doesn't do this every day of the week, and so we have some mics, and if we could get a show of hands, and we'll ask each of the questioners to kind of stand up and introduce yourself. So do we have a question? Okay.
Good morning. I'm Christine Cohen, County Auditor Controller. I had a couple of questions just to follow up on your comment on the mark-to-market rules and whether you would suggest, what kind of suggestions would you make to change those regulations that may be very onerous now? And also your comment on the level of credit card debt that we're still faced with in this nation. Thank you.
Well, first, mark-to-market. That's really a SEC, well, it's sort of a twofold thing. There's a FASB rule about requirements of mark-to-market, and then the SEC is requiring publicly traded companies to mark-to-market. There has been a tremendous amount of discussion about the impact that is having on financial institutions, and but Mr. Cox, who's head of the SEC, has been unwilling to make that change. He will be gone on January 20th. My guess is the first thing that will happen with the new chair of the SEC is they will eliminate the mark-to-market rule. Now, that doesn't mean FASB will change because they are much more entrenched, but I think that you'll see a change. I don't think that the mark-to-market rule will be continued because there seems to be such general consensus that that has created a substantial part of the problem. As far as credit card debt is concerned, I think that's sort of the next shoe, and it's already starting to fall. I mean, when companies like American Express, which presumably takes the cream of the crop for issuing credit cards, is showing drastic drop in earnings, I think there's certainly no question about that. The other side of the coin is that people are not spending as much, so my guess is that the amount of the increase in debt is, consumer debt is not going to increase. It may even go down, but still, there are a lot of people who are overextended with credit cards, and that's showing up in the credit market.
Okay, another question. Very good. Right in front here. Just for those of you who couldn't hear, a question about the residential rental market. Do you see rents coming down? And if cap rates are going to go up, where does that leave the investor?
Well, first, as far as rents are concerned, we have actually made a corporate decision to freeze rents in our apartments for the next year. And we've told our residents that because we see a deteriorating rental market as well as a sales market, I think, for several reasons. First, people are moving out of California. I think there is more doubling up. You would have expected that with the amount of foreclosures that have gone on that people would be moving out of houses and into apartments. But we see a softening market, and we think that rents are going to stay level or maybe even drop a bit. We see that even more in Ventura County than we do in Santa Barbara, but we see the same trend in Santa Barbara County. In terms of rents being rather flat and cap rates going up, yeah, I mean, I got offers on apartment buildings a couple of years ago. I'm really sorry I didn't take. And, I mean, that's the nature of the real estate business. There are swings up and swings down, and I think that prices are going to be going down because cap rates are going up. I think for people who have projects, whether they're residential projects or commercial projects, that had short-term loans or loans that are coming due in the next year or two, they could have some big problems out there, and there may be a lot of properties on the sale for rather distressed prices because either they can't get refinancing or the rates are going up substantially or they're being told they can only get a 60% loan to value instead of a 75 or 80% loan to value because the lenders are being more conservative.
I tried charging my dog rent, but couldn't get the term sheet right, I guess. You might say, we have another question. Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Bob Breitman. I am a lecturer in the MPPA program here at CLU. My question has to do with housing prices, housing availability, and transportation. Every day, 15,000 people or more drive between Ventura and Santa Barbara to go to work and back in the evening. While the housing prices may be depressed now, the median price house in Santa Barbara is still, what, $1.2 million or whatever it is. Would you care to comment on the need for building additional houses in tri-counties in order to house people who have jobs here?
I think we're okay with that. One of my favorite subjects. I think Santa Barbara has not done its fair share in housing the people who work there. And I spend a lot of time at the city council meetings and board of supervisors meetings making that same pitch. The problem in Santa Barbara, and I'm sure there are other places like that, is people move to Santa Barbara and say, I love it. I love it just the way it is. I don't want to see anything change. And what they don't realize is that the community is changing. It may not be changing physically, but it's changing in terms of the people who are living there. And the problem is getting worse. Hiring nurses or teachers or firemen or policemen is getting harder and harder. And that problem is going to be exacerbated as people who bought houses 20, 30, 40 years ago retire and move on. Fill those jobs, they're not going to be able to afford those same houses. So those people who bought the houses, you know, back in the 70s and 80s may have paid $40,000 or $50,000 for a house. Now they have to pay in Santa Barbara $750,000 for it. So the problem is going to get considerably worse, and I don't think that the train is necessarily the solution because I don't think you can convince most Californians to abandon their cars. So I see the traffic just getting worse on 101. I don't see that there's a community will to provide housing for the people who are working in Santa Barbara.
Another question?
Larry Kennedy, Oxnard College Job and Career Center. For much of the time you were in business, there was a unwritten or written rule, a ratio of a person's income for residential loan of 35% or something like that. And then it changed. What happened?
Well, are you thinking that it went up or it went down? I think lenders are just being more conservative. And, in the face of all the foreclosures that they've seen, it's a sort of a belt and suspenders kind of an attitude, and that's been one of the challenges in the housing market, and particularly for builders who have a new product. When a lender forecloses on a house, they may be a little more willing to be a little more lenient in terms of getting that house off their books and providing lender financing for it. But if it's a new house with a construction loan and you're talking to a Countrywide or a Wells Fargo or a Chase, They are tending to be pretty conservative these days.
There, Hugh, go ahead.
Hugh Ralston with the Community Foundation. You've spent 40 years in the Central Coast, and as you look at getting through the current troubles, are you optimistic for the next 40 years about prospects for community and for healthy economy in the Central Coast, or are we looking at more significant structural problems?
Oh, good question. Are you a long-term optimist over the next 40 years?
Well, I don't think you can be in the development business and not be an optimist. You'd be doing something else for a living. So long-term, this is still a great place to live. I think we have problems that we have to be prepared to deal with, and I'm hoping that, you know, as time goes by, we will do it. And frankly, I found that we've made more progress in solving problems in times of crisis than when things are good and everyone says everything is wonderful and the problem sort of gets swept under the rug. So I'm optimistic that some of the problems we have today will make people more aware of the issues and be prepared to deal with them.
Hi, Dawn Dyer. Dawn Dyer, Dyer Sheehan Group in Ventura. Hi, Michael. I have a quick question about AB 32, the California Global Warming Act, and the changes that I at least anticipate it's really going to have on how we live and work and do business in California. Is your firm and your organization anticipating significant changes? The first real land use piece of that we've seen is the SB 375, which really seems to favor high-density, transit-oriented development, which is difficult in places like Santa Barbara and Ventura County, where we don't have transit. Just very interested in how you're anticipating that will affect your operations over the next couple of decades.
Well, I think the goal of those bills was to create more energy efficient communities, encourage infill, higher density housing to meet the affordable housing needs in communities. But local government does a wonderful job of evading those rules. And so I'm not terribly optimistic that we will see much progress or that it will happen very quickly. Housing elements are a good example. Housing elements are supposed to provide guidelines for communities to plan their future growth, and it encourages more compact development. And I know in Santa Barbara County they do a wonderful job of avoiding or evading those kinds of things. So I don't tend to be too optimistic about that. And unless there's, you know, politicians read the tea leaves and they do what their constituents want. And so I think until the public says, you know, we need to do more of infill, more compact development, it's going to be hard to see that happening. And there's always this attitude, well, we don't want those people living next to us. You know, we're in favor of more affordable housing, but put it over there, not here. So I think there's a real challenge to trying to make those things work, unless the state really puts in some draconian penalties for not doing it. And so far, I just don't see any sense that they're doing that.
Just a quick follow-up to that question. You know, California's been at the leading edge of technology, and there's been a tremendous amount of venture capital investment in green and alternative technology, and our president-elect has been talking about 5 million jobs from green technology. Do you think that's a myth? Do you think that's daydreaming? And do you think that our region, where we have got a fair history of innovation, will benefit from new technology that's basically green or based on energy efficiency?
Well, I think, you know, we will see more of that as time goes by. I think one of the problems in the past in the housing business is that as we've become more energy efficient, the public has sort of been a little bit behind. For example, builders that were providing additional energy efficiency in terms of greater insulation and other things in their homes to reduce energy for many years found that buyers were not willing to pay that additional cost. Now, I think attitudes change, and it takes a while for that to happen. And it's also a function of the cost of energy. You know, I think we were headed in a direction where we really were going to do some substantial things when oil was $145 a barrel. People tend to go back to their own old patterns when those energy costs drop. So I think there were many good things about oil at $140 or $150 a barrel.
Okay, next question.
I'm Tim Smite. I was formerly with UniCal in Investor Relations, and now I work over at the library here, where our patronage is going up, hopefully not at the expense of the bookstore. Anyway, my question, you mentioned a lot about the downturn we faced in the early 70s. One of the big differences, I think, now is we're part of a global economy, and although this crisis may have started with the housing bubble here and the credit crisis, it's a global crisis now. I'm wondering to what extent you think the actions we take will have to be coordinated with the EU, with China, with the rest of the world.
I think that's a very good point. And I think one of the things which is exacerbating the recession we have now is that it's a global recession. And in the past, many of these recessions have been in the United States, have not been matched other places in the world, and that helped pull us out of that recession. So. And I think there are really substantial efforts being made to coordinate steps to try to deal with this recession, because this, for the first time, is a global recession. And even countries like China are seeing a drop in their growth rates. So I think countries have learned a lot from past experience, and that's positive. And I think there is a lot more coordination now than global coordination than we've seen in the past.
Do we have one more question? Well, we have one more.
Let's talk about the auto industry a little more. What's your view about what should happen?
Well, I started out thinking that we have to keep these companies going and we can't let them go into Chapter 11. I recently read an article about British Leyland, where the government put billions of dollars into that company, and they still went broke. And I just think the problems are so deep-seated there that Chapter 11 is probably the best thing that could happen. I don't think it will be the end of the world. Most of the major airlines in this country went through Chapter 11, and they came out stronger than they were before. And I think the amount of change that's going to be required to make them competitive in a world market can't be accomplished without something like that.
Great question. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me invite you all to do three things. The first, of course, is to fill out the evaluation card and leave it at the door on your way out. The second is to invite you back for the next in this series, 2 months from today, February 3rd, 2009. Our speaker will be George Cogswell, publisher of the Ventura County Star, who is here with us this morning, and we look forward to hearing from him in February. Michael also mentioned the UCSB economic forecast, and I wanted to invite you to come back here on February 19th for breakfast when the UCSB 2009 economic forecast will be presented, and I know we'll have great interest in what we hear then. I, for one, hope for better trend lines than we were seeing earlier this morning. Finally, thank you all very much for being here, and I want to say, despite the clouds over the economic horizon, that we here at the university thank you for your support and wish you all a very, very blessed holiday season, and look forward to seeing you again in 2009. And thank you again to Michael and Henry.